Hi, everybody. My name is Pat Yeo, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be sober. I'm nervous, and I don't usually get nervous when I talk. I don't know why I am. It doesn't matter. I am. So there. I was in a last Saturday, I was in a little eight-step meeting with, there were ten of us in the meeting. There were a couple of old-timers and a couple of people around 4 or 5 years sober and a couple of new people and one guy who was clearly brand spanking new. He looked like he lived on the streets. And so we went around the room and we read from the 12 and 12. We read the step and then everybody started sharing. And it was good sharing. And then it got to him and he said, Jesus Christ, you mean I have to apologize to people I've been screwing over for 30 years? We said, well, it appears you haven't even taken step one yet, so don't even worry about it today, you know. All in good time. But I understood how he felt, you know. The first time I heard that step read, though, I didn't really think, I seriously sat in my chair and thought, no, I don't think I've hurt anybody. And I believed that for a long time. And then I, when I got, I'm just going to read this one little thing, when I was sober a little bit longer, and they started, I started to get to this step, because I'm thinking, well, I didn't steal from anybody. Well, actually, I had, but I didn't remember it at the time. But it talks about, we might ask ourselves what we mean when we say it, that we have harmed other people. What kinds of harm do people do one another? To define the word harm in a practical way, we might call it the result of instincts and collision. Goes on to say, if our tempers are consistently bad, we arouse anger. If we lie or cheat, we deprive others. If our sex conduct is selfish, we may excite jealousy, misery, and a strong desire to retaliate in kind. Then it talks about how we behave in our family. Are we cold or callous, or do we have self-pity oozing from every pore? Yeah, okay, well, maybe there are some amends I need to make then, you know. I didn't like it, but eventually I got to where I could see that there were. You know, I started drinking when I was 13, and I started drinking then because alcohol was there. It was at a party, and I drank, and the magic happened for me, which is that it changed how I felt. You know, I relaxed. I could talk to people. I was have always described myself as being incredibly shy, and, of course, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you call that self-obsession. And I prefer shy. Shy implies I can't help it, not really my fault, but self-obsession is what it is. And I drank rum and coke that night, and it went away. You know, I felt totally comfortable. I could talk to people. I could dance. I don't know if I could dance. I felt like I could dance. And I just had, I felt great, you know. I blacked out that night. I passed out, and I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know. A lot more than I meant to do that night. But that was to become, and you know, the next morning I felt embarrassed and ashamed and I was terrified that I'd get pregnant. Whatever bad feelings you might imagine a 13-year-old girl would, although I don't know, 13-year-olds today look like they're 40, but when I was 13, it wasn't happening that much, and I felt bad, but I drank again at the very next possible opportunity without a second thought, because I was it did something for me that I wanted doing, and my behavior when I drank never got much better than that. When I drink, I get friendly. So I developed this reputation in high school for being a friendly girl, and, you know, that's not really how I wanted people to think about me. I wanted people to admire and respect me. I wanted to, I wanted to grow up and get married and stay married to the same person forever and live a decent life. But, you know, I'm 13, 14, 15 years old, and it's kind of clear in my mind it's not happening for me. I did get married when I was 18. Because he asked. He wasn't even the one I liked the best, but I remember when he asked me, feeling this sort of big sigh of relief that I wasn't going to have to think about that anymore. Now, I wasn't even aware that I had been thinking about it, but clearly, you know, in retrospect, I can see that I had no self-worth. I really had no self-worth whatsoever, and so when he asked, I'm like, yes, and so we got married, and we had this huge church wedding. You know, if you're not sure about something, overdo it. That's my motto. And I remember walking down the aisle on my dad's arm and, the dress and the everything and thinking, this is probably a mistake. As I'm walking down the aisle. Now, I know that's not how you're supposed to be feeling at that very moment, you know, but I just walked down the aisle and said, I do. And now we're married. And You know, when we were dating, I lived at home with my folks. He lived at home with his folks. And so we had money from our little part-time jobs we had. We went to parties. We drank. And but now we're married, and we have rent and utilities and food and things we have to buy. We didn't have money to drink. And I can see so clearly in retrospect, none of this was clear at the time, that I needed a drink. You know, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I don't remember ever having a fight with him, but I needed a drink. And so when the first opportunity presented itself to get out, I got out. I left him without without any notice, really. My brother had died in kind of a tragic accident, and I felt a lot of guilt about it, and I really had no guilt. I guess I should tell the story, because then everybody's going, what did she do to him? My brother was in the Navy, and he was injured in an accident on board his ship. The ship was in Japan at the time, and they took him off the ship, put him in a hospital in Japan, and then the ship sailed. So he's in a foreign country, he doesn't speak the language, badly injured in the hospital, he's alone. And nobody in our family really had the money to go be with him, so I started sending him cards every day, hoping to cheer him up, and funny cards. And about a month went by, and his condition seemed to be improving somewhat, and my mother was notified that he was probably going to be shipped back to the States, and that he wasn't well, but that he'd probably be in the Naval Hospital in San Diego, which was great news for us. And right around the time we got that telegram, I sent another of these cards. Was intended to be funny. On the front, it said, heard you were ailing, but not to worry. And on the inside, it said, only the good die young. And I sent it, and he died. And I felt so, so terrible about that card. Honestly, I don't think I could have felt worse if I had killed him myself. I couldn't believe I'd sent such a stupid, stupid card. My prayer was that card didn't get there in time. My prayer was that he died before that stupid card arrived. The day his trunk of belongings got shipped back to my mother, she opened the trunk, and that card was in there, laying on the top. It had been opened. And I took it when nobody was looking and went in the bathroom and tore it up in little pieces and flushed it down the toilet and just cried and cried and cried. I never told anybody about that card until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous years later and did an inventory, because I felt so bad about it. And that's how I live my life. I just pile stuff in there and keep secrets and just keep feeling worse and worse and worse and worse. And so I'm crying all the time. My brother's dead. I'm crying all the time. And my husband didn't know how to help me with what he thought was just ordinary grief, whatever that might be. And so he said to me one day, maybe if you go stay with your parents for a while, maybe your mother can somehow help you with this grief, because I don't know how to help you. And so I went to stay with my mother, and I never lived another day with him. Didn't really quite understand what had happened there. He called, he wrote, he offered to go to marriage counseling. He just didn't know what had happened. And I couldn't tell him what had happened, because I didn't know what had happened. I just knew that I simply could not go back there. So I didn't. I divorced him, and that was that. I was, 19. We were married 6 months. Which, by the way, as an aside, I don't think you have to count marriages that are 6 months and under. Just saying. That's my personal opinion. So I was 19 when I divorced him. I got sober when I was almost 31, and I didn't see him, you know, all that time. And I was sober a few months, and I saw him. And I thought, wow, this is pretty crazy. Here I am, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and God drops this guy in my path. Here's an opportunity to make amends. And my next thought was, I'm not sober all that long, and I'm not actually to that step yet. And I let that opportunity pass by. That was 37 years ago, and I haven't seen him from that day to this. There's a line somewhere in here that says something about calling it prudence when it's, let's not talk prudence while practicing evasion. That's kind of what I was doing, and I did it. I'm getting this bad one out of the way first, because then I'm hoping I'll leave you with, like, positive memories at the end of my talk. So I just sort of ignored it. And periodically I'd think of it, and I'd think, oh well, I can do that later. And before I knew it, 40 years had passed, and it started really bothering me. And I spoke to my sponsor, and she said, I guess it was 45 years actually, and I said, you know, I never made amends to this first husband. And with the internet today, you can find anybody. And so I had knew where he was. He was in Orange County at the time, and he was married. And I So I talked to my sponsor, and she said, you know, I don't think that, I think this comes under the heading of being careful not to hurt people or other people when you're making your amends. She said, I don't think you can leap into his life 45 years after the fact to make amends. She said, it seems to me that you might be creating grounds for new amends to be made, you know, creating perhaps jealousy or bad feelings with his current family. Maybe we were married so briefly. Maybe he has never even mentioned that he was married previously. You don't know the lay of the land, Pat. I think that you've let an opportunity go by, and I think you need to sit on this. And it was hard because you know how we are. Now, 45 years after the fact, by God, I want to do this now. And so I wrote a letter to him. I didn't mail it. I wrote a letter, and it's actually sealed and addressed to him. It's in the glove compartment of my car. If I die this weekend, let somebody know. They can put it in the mail. I don't know. You know, I don't know if I even would have it mailed then, but I remain ready, willing, and able, and I hope that God gives me another shot at making amends to him. You know, I really wish that I had done it. I always like to tell that story when I'm talking about amends, because even though it embarrasses me and makes me feel ashamed, because I really I feel so strongly about making amends. You know, it's the thing that's made the biggest difference in my life. You know, and what a shame! What a shame that I let that opportunity pass by. After I divorced him, sorry, I'm getting over bronchitis, and now I'm down to the hacking, annoying cough. Wow. Doesn't taste good. I was going to ask for a glass, and then I thought, oh, please, Pat, like you never drank out of a bottle before. After I divorced my first husband, I grew up in Orange County, moved up to Los Angeles. I got a job in an apartment, and my first job there was as a secretary at a trucking company. My parents were divorced when I was young, and please, if you're going to get me a glass, don't do that. Really. He's, honest to God, he's the best host in the world, and I've not let him do a thing all weekend long, but really, I don't need it. Thank you, though. Aaron, wonderful host. We're not even going to talk about his buddy who picked me up at the airport. We're just not even going to go there. We had a little trouble finding each other in the airport. Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, my first real job. Actually, it's not my first real job. My first real job was for JCPenney Company. This is when I was actually married to that first husband, and I worked in the credit and layaway department, and cash crosses that counter. You know, people pay for their gift wrapping, and so cash that you don't actually have to account for cross. You're supposed to, obviously, but I don't know. Some of it found its way into my pocket. You know, what can I say? And I don't know how much, you know. I don't know how much, because it was over the course of the year or whatever that I worked there. You know, a little here, a little there, maybe a little merchandise. I'm not sure, you know. But when I got sober, I did not have that on my amends list. That was one of those things I just had completely blocked out of my mind. And I was speaking at a meeting, under the bridge meeting, on steps 8 and 9 one time. I was probably sober 15 years or something, and they asked questions, and somebody said, have you ever stolen, like, from a department store? And I said, well, yes, actually. And I explained that I had, you were probably at that meeting, huh? And I said, you know, I work for Penny's, and I said, what I just told you. And the guy, whoever was asking the question, said, well, how did you pay it back? And I said, I just wrote a check and sent it to them. Now that the whole story is true except that last sentence. Now, I'm standing at an AA podium. I've just told this major lie. And I'm starting to sweat. And the guy asked like a follow-up question. And I elaborated on my lie a little bit. I had taken a girl I sponsor with me to the meeting that night. People thanked me, and we got in the car. I hope that girl wasn't talking about committing suicide that night, because I did not hear a word she said in the car on the way home. I was a wreck. So I get home, and I say to my husband, Vince, who's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I go, "Oh, God, Vince, I just did this horrible thing." And I tell him what happened, and I'm thinking he's going to say something to comfort me. He says, "Jesus, Pat, you did what?" So now it's like 11:30 at night. There's absolutely nothing I can do about this tonight. You can imagine how I slept or didn't sleep. So I get up the next morning, and I think I've got to make this right. So I call JCPenney, the store that I work for, and I say to the woman, the receptionist, whatever, could I speak to your store manager, please? And she said, "May I ask who's calling?" And I said, "Well, my name is Pat." "Yeah, it will mean nothing to him. And may I tell him what it's regarding?" "Yeah, 35 years ago or whatever it was, I worked for your company and I stole some money and I'd like to arrange to pay it back." And she's like, "One moment, please." Like, she gets these calls all the time, you know. So I get the store manager and I give him my little spiel, and I say, "How would I go about actually paying this money back?" And he said, "Well, you can just write a check and send it." And he said, "Send it with a little note to my attention so it'll remind me, what this is for." Okay, fine. So I actually didn't know how much money it was because, as I mentioned, I had taken it a little here, a little there. So I prayed about it for a couple of days, and I came up with a figure that I knew was enough and enough plus, I would rather pay a little too much than not enough. So I came up with a figure that felt right to me. And I wrote the check, and I wrote this little note and sent it off, and then I kind of waited for, the thank you. It never came. It just never came. But I'm thinking, as I sent that off, I'm thinking, God, thank God I took care of that. I'm thinking that's the end of it. 6 months later, the new secretary of the Under the Bridge meeting called me and said, "Could get you down to speak?" I said, "Oh, sure." And we pick a date, and then they tell you like what step they're on or what tradition or whatever. And he said, "Oh, you'll be talking on steps 8 and 9. And I said, "I talked about that last time I was there. Wouldn't you rather hear me talk about something different?" And he said, "Oh, no, we love to hear you talk about steps 8 and 9. Just shoot me, you know." So I go to the meeting. There's old-timers there that I respect and admire. I want them to like me, and I had to stand at their podium and say, 6 months ago when I was here, I told a big lie at this podium and had to, tell them the story. It was humiliating. It was just humiliating. Trust me when I tell you it's just easier to make these amends. Just do it, So that's, that's my JCPenney story. I drank in the bars and in the streets as long as I could. I never, my behavior was horrible. As I said, I was friendly and, it just got worse. And, the people and the places and the kinds of things that I was doing were, just worse. And, I had my mariachi phase where I had discovered this mariachi band in San Juan Capistrano, which is not exactly around the corner from where I was living in Los Angeles. At that time, it was probably like a 4-hour drive. Now, at the time, it was maybe an hour and a half drive or something. And they had this mariachi band, 8 or 10 guys in the band, that played there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night at this little place. And then they stayed in a little local motel there. And then on Sunday nights, after they finished, they drove back to Tijuana, presumably to their wives and many children. I don't know because I don't speak English. I mean, speak Spanish. And so they didn't speak English. And so I somehow discovered this place, and I was there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, and I was a mess. I was just a mess. The first thing I'd do is give the bartender my purse. He'd put it behind the bar because I was prone to losing things, and I would sit at the bar, and the band would play, and I would ask him to play, those sad songs, and I didn't know what they meant, but the music seemed sad, And then there was a little dance floor where the patrons of the bar could dance. And at some point during the evening, one of these musicians would put his instrument down and ask me to dance. And I can remember this like it was yesterday, moving around the dance floor with Jose or whomever and thinking that all of you, the other patrons in that bar, were looking at me with awe and admiration, thinking I must be somebody because I know the band. I did indeed know the band. I knew the entire band. I went there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night for the better part of a year. I don't know why I stopped going. I can only assume that something happened by my diminishing standards that it was so horrible that I just couldn't go back, because that's what I do. I was sober, I don't know, 10 years or something, and I was speaking at a meeting not far from there, and I got down there really early and had some time to kill, and I drove around to see if I could find it. It's still there. It's kind of spruced up a little bit. And excuse me. And I parked the car. It was dark. I parked the car across the street and just sat in the car and kind of looked through the door for a few minutes thinking about that time. And, you know, I went there for the better part of a year, 4 or 5 nights a week, and I couldn't, sitting in my car that night, I couldn't remember one single happy time that I had in there. I couldn't remember one single, like, really great laugh or one single really, fun time or anything. Every memory I have from that place is embarrassing and sort of degrading and just awful. And yet I went there all the time. You know, that's what alcoholism does to me, you know. I woke up in a Skid Row hotel room one day with a man that didn't speak any English. And there's a theme going here, you'll see. It was a work day. I had to go to work that day, and the bathroom was down the hall somewhere. I remember I went down there and tried to, you know, pull myself together in some kind of shape to go to work. Remember those days when you went to work and what you were wearing yesterday? And I go back to the room to get my things, and this man held out some money to me because that's what he thought I was. Evidently, it's what I was. I took his money. But I did not feel good about it. You know, when I drove away from that hotel that morning, I felt, I was probably 22 years old, maybe. I felt 122. And the worst part of it was I knew I was going to do it again and again and again. I left the church that I grew up in when I was a sort of an old teenager. And I, you know, I've heard a lot of people in AA say that they left the church that they grew up in because of they didn't like the teachings of the church. Or I don't know, my church taught a loving God who would forgive me everything. The problem was I knew I was going to keep doing it. You know, I had to separate myself from that church because I knew that while God would forgive me, you know, I kind of felt like he's going to lose patience here. You know, you can't keep asking for forgiveness for the same thing. And so I left that church and didn't go back for a long, long, long time. I went from job to job. I started to tell you about my dad, and I got sidetracked. My dad, did I tell you? Oh, my God, I'm getting old. Please tell me I didn't tell you the story about my job. Oh, thank you, Steve. My first real job after the JCPenney thing was as a secretary for this trucking company in Los Angeles. My father, my real father, my parents were divorced. My real father was vice president of the company, and I asked him for a job. You know, when you're young and you've never had a job before, it's hard to get that first job. And I had these good skills, but I'd never actually used them on a job. And so I called him and said, you know, would you consider hiring me? And I remember he said, oh, honey, I don't know. I'm really kind of reluctant to hire a family member. He should have listened to his instincts. But I begged, and he, I'm sure, felt guilt. And so he hired me. And the agreement was that I could work there for a year. And then I would have a good, solid year on my resume, and then I would move on. It was a good opportunity. I was grateful for it. It really was a good opportunity. So I went to work there. But I'm an alcoholic. And now I'm drinking, and I'm behaving there the same way that I behaved in high school, which is to say that I'm knowing most of these truck drivers in the biblical sense. They were all bowling was the big thing then. They were all in this bowling league, and I don't bowl, but I was, of course, at the bowling alley all the time and taking people home with me and, you know, behaving badly and people talking about me. And one day my father called me. I mean, obviously word of my behavior is, you know, getting up to his office, and he called me one day and tried to talk to me about me. You know, I can't even look at this behavior very closely myself. I really can't even really think about it. If I think, I'll have a drink instead of thinking about that. I most certainly cannot talk to my father about it. I can't. And so the end result of that conversation was I said some really ugly things to him on the phone, and we didn't really speak again until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and made amends to him. We spoke at weddings and funerals, and then he once a year or so would come take me out to lunch, and we would have these very stilted, it was like having lunch with a stranger, really. You know, we'd have these sort of stilted, I'd talk about my job or, you know, but nothing, no real personal interaction between us at all. When I got sober and made my amends list, you know, I sat down with my sponsor after I'd made the list, and she said, who do you think of all the, you know, people you need to make amends to on this list, who do you think, Pat, would be the easiest one or the one that would go the smoothest? And I said, my dad, because he's a very spiritual guy. He's very active in his church, and he's very, just the spirit, he lives a spiritual life. And I said, I think that whatever I say, it would be well received. And she said, well, why don't we start with him? It's good to get a, you know, check off a good one before you get into some of the hard ones. So, okay, so he's coming to take me to lunch this day, and this is the day I'm going to talk to Dad. And we get in the car, and I'm drenched in sweat just thinking about it. I don't really know how to start. I can't remember what my sponsor and I talked about exactly, you know. And we get to the restaurant, and every time I'm almost have my, you know, I'm ready, and then the waiter would come by or something. And we finish lunch. We're in the car going back to my office, and I've said nothing of any importance at all. And he pulled up in front of my office, which was at the corner of Sunset and Vine, which is like a major corner. Big traffic, and he sort of just double parked so I could hop out of the car, and I turned to him and I said, Daddy, I really need to talk to you. And he seemed to understand that it was important, and he pulled into a parking lot, and we had this lovely long talk, and I told him that I knew I'd been, you know, just such a terrible daughter to him, and then I was sorry for that, and then I knew there was, you know, that I'd caused him so much embarrassment at his company, And he was still at that company. He retired from that company. I'm sure he's hoping that all the people who knew me then have died or left or something. But, you know, and as I suspected, it was very well received. He was very loving about it. And actually, a few years later, he made amends to me and said, you know, that he felt, you know, was kind of, you know, guilty and sad that he had left my mother and not been there, you know, to, that he thought that perhaps my life might have turned out different. And I, you know, that's just the kind of guy he is. I don't think that's the truth, by the way. Somebody else or a couple people have said it. You know, there's no blame here, you know. This alcoholism is on me, you know. It doesn't matter what they have done to me, you know. It's my side of the street that needs cleaning up. When I was drinking, I was working at the next company I worked for after I actually left his company before the year was up because of my behavior. You know, I was behaving so badly, and it gets embarrassing to go into work and face people, you know. I did drink a lot in blackouts and quite grateful for it, actually, but I remember enough. I've quit jobs after office Christmas parties without going back to clean out my desk because I knew I couldn't face them in the light of day. I quit. Here's how I went out with my boss and my coworkers one night. We're bar hopping around downtown. LA. We're all drunk. But maybe I was drunker than the rest of them. Because we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. I know you'll understand this when I explain it to you. Not my fault, really. We were at this table. The stage was like here. We were at this table right here. And I had excused myself from the table to go to the ladies' room, which was down the hall behind the stage. And bumped into the owner of the bar in the hallway there and made some derogatory remarks about the caliber of his entertainment. And he said something along the lines of, if I thought I was such hot stuff, which apparently I thought. So a moment ago, I was sitting at the table with my boss and my coworkers dressed kind of like I'm dressed now. And now moments later, I'm on the stage essentially dressed in nothing. And there was that wonderful moment when my boss's eye and mine met, when he realized who that was up there. I swear, I'll never forget the look on his face, ever. It was a moment. When I sobered up the next day, I couldn't believe I'd done that. It gave me ideas. It might have been a strip joint. I mean, really. That is, but it gave me ideas. This is kind of when go-go dancing was just becoming popular, and all the nice clubs on Sunset Strip had go-go dancers, and to me it seemed classier than stripping. It's not, but I had convinced myself that it was, and so I went and got this job as a paid go-go dancer, not in one of those nice clubs on Sunset Strip. My first job was on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles. Never met anybody there who spoke English. Again, this ongoing theme. Then I moved uptown to it seemed uptown because they spoke English in the next place, but it was kind of on the outskirts of Chinatown and downtown LA, which is another way of saying it was kind of on the outskirts of Skid Row because they come perilously close together there. And I was working there at Nick's, and I was working in the day as a secretary and getting off work and going, you know, now, remember I said I was shy? You don't think I do this kind of work sober, do you? So I get off work from the secretarial job. I go to the bar. I have a few drinks while I'm getting dressed or undressed, as the case may be. And then I go to work, and I work till 2. And I met the man who was to become my second husband there at Nick's. He was a customer. Clearly recognized talent. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that dancing talent was not necessarily a requirement of the job. And I'm not much of a dancer, but we met, and he was possibly the most unsuitable man in the state of California for me. So of course we moved right in together and set up housekeeping, and God, I'm getting just hot talking about it. Have one of those hot flashes, Larry. We got married in Vegas by a judge who was wearing bedroom slippers. It was oh so romantic. We'd been sitting in the car drinking a pint of something before he drank. I mean, I met him in a bar. Now we're married. It turns out he didn't drink as much as I did, and my drinking and my behavior behind drinking got to be this big topic of conversation around our house. And you know, I'm married now, but I'm still behaving like I'm single. You know, when I go out and drink, anything's likely to happen. You know, people say, you know, you can't predict what's going to happen. I pretty much could. Something bad's going to happen, you know. And it's probably going to be a man involved, you know. And so I'd go out after work. I'd working as a secretary again, and I'd go out to call my husband and say, I'm going to go out with the girls for a drink, which is a joke. I've turned down drinks when I've known there was only going to be a drink. But I would go out and, you know, then not come home or come home missing parts of my clothing or, you know, it was bad. We had a lot of trouble in that marriage, a lot of trouble, all caused by my behavior. I will talk a little bit more about that. I want to try to do this kind of, I actually wrote a little list. I want to do things chronologically so it makes sense, but my mind just doesn't work that way. So I've already, like, skipped all over my list. When I was drinking, I was working at this company. This is one of those amends that are hard to make because the person's not there anymore. You know, I was working at this company. There were 30 girls in this big secretarial pool, one big room, 30 desks. And there was this one girl that nobody liked. I didn't like her. Nobody liked her. I was nicer to her than anybody else, not because I'm a nicer person, because I'm not, but because our desks faced each other, backed right up to each other. I'm looking at her all day long. It is in my best interest to be nice to her because it makes my day easier. It has nothing to do with being a nice person, trust me. So this girl is getting married, and she asked me to be a bridesmaid in her wedding, which I thought, wow, that's kind of sad, actually, that I'm like the closest person to her, that she had her sister and her couple of sisters and me. But I said yes, and so now the wedding date is approaching. Her aunt called me one day and said, could you give me the addresses, the names and addresses of the other girls in the office? I want to throw a surprise shower, and I want to invite all those girls. And so I provided the information. The night of the shower came up. I lived in Long Beach at the time. The shower, I think, was in Woodland Hills. It was raining. I thought, oh, man, that's a long drive in the rain. I don't even really like this girl. I guess I have to go. I mean, I am a bridesmaid. I mean, really, you know. I think I'll just stop and have a drink, and it'll just make the whole thing so much more bearable. And I didn't go. I never made it. The next day, she came in the office, and she stood right in the middle of the office and said, so everybody could hear it, thanks a lot, everybody. My aunt threw a surprise shower last night, and not one of you showed up. I have no idea how those other 29 girls felt, but I'll tell you, I felt about as bad as I've ever felt in my life. I couldn't believe I'd done such a horrible thing. Now, when I made my amends list, that was not on there. It was not on there, not because I was trying to avoid it, I had so blocked that out of my mind. I mean, it was gone from my, it was gone until I was sober about 5 years maybe, and I was down at my mother's house, and she said, oh, that box of pictures over there, I think they're yours. And on the top was a picture of that wedding party. Oh, my God. I mean, I just thought, oh, my God. I owe this girl, seriously owe this girl amends, but I don't even remember her maiden name or her married name. I have no idea. This is many years later. I would have not a clue where to find her. I wouldn't know her if she was standing in front of me, you know, at the moment. How do you make amends for that? I don't know. And so I talked to my sponsor, and she said, you need to pray about that and ask God to show you some way. She said, there's a way, but we just don't know what it is yet. But if you are willing and you ask God for help, he'll show you. And so I started asking God to show me, you know, how do I do this? Well, it occurred to me one day, I was a member of the Pacific Group, which many of you know is a huge group. 900 people attend that, you know, that group. People are always getting married and having babies, and so there's showers all the time. I didn't go to them. I don't like showers. But it occurred to me that maybe a way of making sort of the universal amends would be to start attending these showers that go on in the group and show up dressed appropriately with a little gift and act like I'm having a good time. And so I started doing that, and it felt right. It felt like this was the right thing to do. So I'm doing that, and I don't know how much time went by, a couple of years maybe. I'm going to all these showers, and I'm not liking any of them very much, but I'm doing it. And one night there's a shower for this girl, and I was living in Pasadena, and she was, I think the shower was in Santa Monica, and it was raining, and I thought, oh, man, I don't want to do this. I just don't want to do this. You know, actually, I've never seen her at anybody else's shower. I don't really think I have to. Now, the whole time I'm working on this scenario, I'm getting dressed, I'm wrapping my gift, I go to the shower. There were three people at that shower that night. I was real glad that I was one of them. Real glad. Now, here's how I think. I remember driving home that night thinking, well, I've done it. I've made that amend. That was the one. You know, I don't think so. I think that's one of those ones I have to do till the day I die. I just think that it is, you know. I don't think we're ever done with some of these, and so I just keep going. I don't want to quit just before the miracle happens here, you know. So I just keep going. I don't like showers much more than I ever did, but I do it because it feels like it's the right way to make amends for that thing. There was I was working one of my jobs when I was drinking. I was working as a secretary in a church, a little church office, and there was I forget which earthquake it was. There, you know, all the earthquakes are named now, but some big earthquake happened when I was working there, and I think 71, the big Sylmar, whatever. And in my apartment, there was, you know, some pictures fell off the wall, and so, you know, some little damage, but nothing, you know, nothing at all. I mean, people died in that earthquake. My little damage was minimal, but I called the church. I was very hungover that morning. It happened early in the morning, and so I called the church office, and I said, oh, God, the earthquake. I mean, my apartment, all the dishes, all the glasses, everything's a big mess, and oh, stay home. They said, you know, take care of what you have to take care of. I parlayed it into several days off cleaning up the wreckage, and when I went back to work, the women in the church had taken up a collection and bought me all new dishes and glasses. Yeah, I thanked them sweetly and took this stuff home, and this was on my amends list when I made my first amends list, and I actually, my sponsor said, well, can you go to the church? And mercifully, I thought at the time, the church was gone. It was a parking lot now. Thank you, God. I thought I don't have to do that, you know, because I just couldn't hardly imagine going there and saying, you know. But again, how do I make amends? If the church doesn't exist anymore, what do I do? Well, many years later, Vince and I had bought this house, and living in Pasadena, and there was an earthquake, and we had a lot of damage to our house, like, I don't know, $60,000 or $70,000 worth of damage. Our chimney came down. There was foundation, a lot of stuff. We actually had to move out for a while while they did the repairs. And so, you know, when earthquakes and stuff like that happen, all the neighbors get together in the street. That's actually how you meet your neighbors usually. And so we're all out there talking. They're all talking about this FEMA money and all this. Oh, yeah, here's the number. Call these people. You get money. You don't have to pay it back. And Vince brought the number inside, and I said, yeah, I don't think I can do that, Vince. I think I got to let this one pass by. I don't think I'm I don't think I can do that. And we let that free money go. And then I also went and did some volunteer work, help, you know, physical kind of helping other people. I just think you can't just forget this stuff and say, oh, well, there's nothing I can do about it. Oh, well, you know, I think there always is something that I can do. But if I'm always thinking in terms of how do I make this right, how do I do this to make it right, then it's clear to me, and it was very clear to me with that earthquake, that it would not be right to take that money, you know, even though clearly we were entitled to it. My relationship with my stepfather was the biggest problem that I had when I got sober. My mother married my stepfather when I was 8 years old, and there was stuff going on in my house that shouldn't have been going on. And I hated him, and I had good reason to hate him. You would agree. Anybody would agree. It was one of the big secrets of my life. I never told anybody. I sat in a psychiatrist's office for the better part of a year at one point, thinking every week when I was in there, I should tell him about my stepfather, but I couldn't do it. I simply could not do it. So I got sober, and I, when I was doing my fourth step, I thought, oh, they're looking for the secrets here. That's the biggest one I got. It's the biggest secret I have. I thought, there's no way I can write that down. There is no way I can do that. But somehow I did. I wrote it in my inventory. Actually, I wrote it down, and I thought, I'm not going to read it. Maybe it's therapeutic enough to write this down, but I'm not ever going to read this to my sponsor. But I found myself, of course, in my sponsor's house, and I read that. So the reason I read it is before I started to read it, I was going to skip that couple of paragraphs. And she said, you know, before we do this, let's just say a little prayer. And we got down on our knees, and she said something about, dear God, please help Pat be honest tonight. And so I read her the whole thing. And, of course, it took me longer to read those two little paragraphs than pages and pages that came after because I cried and carried on, but I did it. And somebody here talked earlier about, you know, their sponsor shared back with them about stuff, and she shared back with me a similar experience, and it took a little the sort of heat off of it. And, you know, as I was driving home from her house that night after doing my fifth step, I remember thinking, whew, got that over with. We're done with that. Yeah, not so much. The longer I stayed sober, it seemed like every meeting I went to, the speaker would sort of lean into the microphone and stare directly at me and say something like, resentments kill alcoholics, especially justifiable resentments. And I had a big one. I mean, I was justifiably resentful at this man. And I couldn't see how I could get rid of that resentment. I started praying every day, asking God to please take it away. I knew, I mean, I've been here long enough to know, I don't want to drink. I need to get rid of this resentment, so dear God, please take it away. And nothing happened. My experience has always been that to have anything happen, I need to ask God for help, and then I need to go do some footwork, whatever it is. There's always footwork involved for me. I finally talked to my sponsor about it, and she said, you know, I think you need to make amends to him. I said, are you kidding me? Have you forgotten maybe my inventory? I mean, I was a kid. No wrongdoing here on my part. And she said, well, let's look at this from a different point of view. She said, I was sober maybe 5 years at this point. I did not leap into this one. She said, by now you've been making daily living amends to your mother for pretty much the whole time you've been sober, for the grief, the anguish, the worry, the torment that you put your mother through. Your stepfather was living in the house at the same time you were causing your mother all that grief. Maybe he was a little concerned, too. Maybe you could just take that sort of same list of things, you know, that you used with your mother and start there. There's a problem with this. I love my mother. I adore my mother. I felt bad when I was doing that. So when I was drunk, I felt bad that I was doing that to my mother. I certainly felt bad when I got sober. And so it was easy for me to go to her and say, I am so, so sorry I was such a terrible daughter to you. I'm going to be a better daughter now. And then I was being a better daughter every day to her. That was easy enough to do because I love my mother. I hate this man. What do I care if he was a little bit worried? You know, I don't care. But again, the bottom line is I don't want to drink. And so I didn't leap into this, but finally one day I thought, okay, fine, I'll go talk to him. So I drove out there. They lived about an hour's drive away at the time. I drove out there and I said, can I talk to you? And we went out in the yard and and I said, essentially something like, I know that I caused a lot of havoc in this house when I was a teenager and the drinking and the worry and all the stuff that I put you through. And I'm really sorry. And obviously I can't change any of that, but I'm going to try to be a better stepdaughter from this point forward and something along those lines. It was short. It was very short. And I left right away because I was afraid if I hung around, I was going to wander off into discussing his shortcomings. And the big book is real clear, It's real clear on this point. That's not my job. My job is to clean up my side of the street. So I kind of said what I had to say, and I left. I'm driving home, and I thought, these steps don't work. I just made amends to him, and I still hate him. Well, I hadn't actually made amends. I'd made the announcement about the amends, but the actual amends is being a kind and loving stepdaughter. I did not actually think I could do it. I started talking about this in my women's meeting, and I got a lot of help. I remember Christmas was coming up that year, and a woman in a meeting who I barely knew said to me, Pat, I don't think that a kind and loving daughter would just rush out on Christmas Eve and pick up a tie and have the store wrap, but I think a kind and loving daughter might put a little more thought into it. And so, okay, so I remember sitting on my couch and asking God for some guidance. He was one of those people who was hard to buy for. Some people just are hard. They don't have hobbies or, he's just hard to buy for, even if you liked him. So I sat on my couch and I said, God, I am totally willing to get this man something that he might like or use or appreciate, but I have no idea what that would be. So help me out here. Give me a little guidance. And I sat on my couch and I waited and, nothing happened. And then it occurred to me that maybe the footwork was to go out to a store where things are. And maybe inspiration would strike. So I went to this mall, and I was walking around the mall, and there was this needlepoint shop. I went in there. At the time, I did needlepoint. And I went in that needlepoint shop, and there was walking around. There was this thing on the wall to needlepoint and frame and hang on the wall, a little saying about fathers and daughters. I thought, no. No, I can't do that. But it, honest to God, it followed me around the store. So I finally bought the damn thing, and I took it home, and I did my nicest work, and I've got it framed, and took it over there at Christmas, and there was this moment when he opened it up and read it. He got a little tear in the corner of his eye. That's here. There's here and gone that fast, just quick. It was the most powerful moment I think I'd had in my whole life up to that moment. I knew in that little instant that God was going to make this resentment bearable enough I would not have to drink over it if I continued to try to do what I was trying to do here, to act as though I was a kind and loving stepdaughter. I think it was the year after that, Vince and I were in, maybe a couple of years later, we were in Yosemite. And when he first married my mother, I was 8 years old, and he took us on this camping trip to Yosemite. We'd never been camping before, and so it was really exciting for my brother and I. And it's one of my happiest childhood memories, actually, that trip. It was just a wonderful, wonderful time. And one of the really great times within that trip was we took this hike up Vernal Falls. And I was, I was young and tired, and I got tired, and he had me on his shoulders when we were coming down, carrying me down, and we were laughing, and it was just a great, great memory. So we were at Yosemite. Ansel Adams has a studio there, and there was a photo of Vernal Falls, so I bought it for him for Christmas that year. And on the card, I wrote essentially what I just told you. This was my happiest child, blah, blah, blah. Christmas came. He opened it up. He loved it. He hung it up right away, and he read the card. And maybe a year after that, I was down at their house, and I happened to sit in his chair, and I looked over, and that card where I'd written that sentiment was laying on the table by his chair, and it was completely dog-eared and almost torn in half. He must have picked that card up thousands of times and read it. I knew that day that I was on the right track. I knew it. Some time later, I don't know how much time, he was in the hospital, And I went down to visit him, and I was sitting by his bed, and I was just talking to him about whatever, you know. And they announced that visiting hours were over, and I got up to leave, and I bent over, and I kissed him on the forehead. I said, "Goodbye, I love you." I was all the way to my car before I realized what I'd said up there. And the truth of the matter is I did. And I don't know, that can't happen. It can't happen, but it did. You know, it did happen. What I believe and feel in my heart, totally 100%, is that he was doing the best he could with the tools he had to work with. I absolutely believe that. Does that, do I forgive what he did? Not necessarily. I mean, it was wrong what he did. But that really doesn't have anything to do with me, with my sobriety, with my personal growth. It has nothing to do with me. When he died, he actually committed suicide. He was a very troubled man, and he was in a coma for a couple of days before he died. And I remember went down and sat by his bed and said a little prayer. And there wasn't any, like, "God, I wish he would wake up so I could say," you know, what, everything had been so long said and so long done, you know. I was able just to be of comfort to my mother and help her. I couldn't believe that something that so consumed my life could just go away like that. I mean, even when I talk about it today, it seems kind of mystical, really. How does that happen? But it happens. You know, it happens all the time here. You hear those kind of stories all the time, and they're true. How are we doing here? I haven't even talked about money yet much. It's the big one. My husband, I am going to talk about that. My husband Vince and I got to talk about him first. Okay, I'm sorry. We're just going to talk about this first. We may never get to money, but I hope we do. When I got sober, I was married to my second husband, the one on whom I'd been cheating all the time, and we had this terrible marriage. And I get sober, and I'm coming to Alcoholics Anonymous every night, and he was not happy about it. I think he was glad I wasn't drinking, but he was not happy I was coming to AA. He thought that I was coming here to meet men. Was not a bad guess. I wanted to be sober. But clearly there are men in AA, and some of you looked interesting to me, and I didn't see that there was a problem with being sober and making some gentlemen friends. None of the men in AA seemed to be interested in me, which hurt my feelings, and it also made me mad my husband was accusing me of something I was not actually doing right at that minute. So we had a lot of trouble in our house. We fought all the time about AA. I went to meetings every night when I was new, and we fought pretty much every night before I left for the meeting. I felt so sorry for myself. I thought I had the saddest life of anybody who ever came to AA. I need to be clear. We'd been fighting all these years before. AA was not ruining our marriage. It's just the new topic. That's all. So I'd come home from work. We'd have this big fight. I'd get in the car. I'd be sobbing hysterically from the fight. I'd be driving to the meeting, and I'd think, you know what? If this is sobriety, you can have it. I'll go to your stupid meeting tonight because I'm already out of the house tonight, but I can't do this. It's too hard. I can't do it anymore. And my sponsor told me to get to every meeting early, so I got to the meeting early and did my commitments, you know, and then went and shook hands with people and tried to act like I cared about them. I didn't care about anybody. And then eventually the meeting would start and I'd get some relief, and then I'd feel a little better when I was driving home, and it would get me through another day and another fight into another meeting. And I felt so, so sorry for myself. After I was sober a few months, it was very clear to me that the problems in this marriage are his fault. I'm working in this spiritual program now. It can't be my fault, you know. I was not exactly working a spiritual program at home, but, you know, I just couldn't see it all very clearly. But with the attitude that I had, it was kind of inevitable that I met a man one night in a meeting who looked real good to me. Actually, I'd met a lot, but one who looked back. I was about 10 months sober. He was about 10 minutes sober. And I spotted him when he came through the door the first night and leapt across a couple of chairs to introduce myself to him. And my sponsor noticed and went over there to her. And she said, "Let's not forget, Pat, that you're a married woman." I said, "Yeah, but I am so unhappy." She said, "Nonetheless, you're married. And as long as you're married, I expect you to act married." So I don't see this as a problem. I would get divorced. And she's like, "No, we in Alcoholics Anonymous don't think it's a good idea to make major moves in our first year of sobriety. You're married, stay married, act married." Well, I was obsessed with this man. why would God get him sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? See, I knew you'd get it. I knew you'd get it. So we began the little death dance, as I now read. You know, it starts with the deep, meaningful glances across the room, and then we're brushing up against each other in the coffee line, and then he's walking me to my car after the meeting, and then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting, and it's kind of complicated to get together. I'm a married woman. Obviously, we're not going to my place. He's a newcomer. He doesn't have a place. Doesn't matter, though. We're pretty resourceful people. I was working at the time at a record company in Hollywood, and he was very conveniently also working in Hollywood at a porn bookstore. You can't make this stuff up. You just can't, you know. I arranged this long lunch hour at work one day for somebody to cover for me, and he didn't have a car either, so I picked him up at the bookstore, and we went to a motel and got to know each other, and dropped him off at the bookstore that afternoon. I was driving back to my office, and it occurred to me in the car that I was 10 months sober, and I was behaving exactly the way I'd always behaved. I'd been sitting in meetings for 10 months, hearing you say pretty much every night that I was going to change everything about the way I'd been living my life, or I was going to drink and die. Not sure what I was thinking during those 10 months, but I believe it was something along the lines of, this doesn't quite apply to me. But I knew that day in the car it did. And I was scared. I'll tell you, in 37 years, that day is the closest I've been to picking up a drink. I was scared to tell my sponsor what I'd done because she'd been so clear about about this matter. But I told her that night what I'd done. And she said, you know, Pat, I don't think you're a woman who can cheat on her husband and stay sober, and you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to. Okay, I don't want to. I've never wanted to. Never, drunk or sober, I never wanted to live this way. I don't see how you're going to help me change it. Here's what I did. A day at a time, I stayed away from that guy. That's it. Day at a time, I didn't drive by that bookstore. Day at a time, I didn't call him. Day at a time, I didn't take his calls. A day at a time, when he called me, or when I saw him in meetings, I would shake hands with a locked elbow. If you're new, that means we never got closer than the entire length of my arm. Hello, and I kept moving. I thought I should explain to him what was happening here. Fortunately, ran that idea by my sponsor, and she said, oh, I think he'll get the idea. And I heard, really heard, for the first time that line that is read at every meeting I go to, half measures avail us nothing. I heard it. And I knew for me, this was huge. For me, this was going to be a big, big turning point. This was going to be the make it or break it for me. And so I did it 100% her way. Now, of course, the obsession passed, because obsessions always pass, but the really good news, and the part I didn't expect, is that I don't live that way anymore. You know, I simply don't live that way anymore. When I was a year and a half sober, my sponsor drank, and I got a new sponsor right away, and the first thing she said, as I've watched you from across the room whine and complain about your marriage, I want you a day at a time to act as though you're a kind and loving wife. This was not an appealing idea. We were not getting along. I didn't see the point. She said, you know, I don't know if your marriage can be saved or not, but you owe a lot of amends to this guy. And the big book is real clear that on these difficult amends. It says right in black and white, you can't make direct amends when to do so might injure that person or others. That means you can't go home and confess infidelities he doesn't know about. This is not about clearing your conscience. It's about making things right. And so she said, I want you a day at a time to act like you're a kind and loving wife. And so I started doing that, and I my heart was not in it, but I started doing it. And I started watching people in AA, how they treat their spouses. Some of it's good, some not so much. And I tried to take what looked good to me and go home and practice it. She taught me an awful lot, just an awful lot of what to do. I could seriously talk all night on that topic alone. So I'm doing this, and a day at a time, and it always sounds so fast when I'm up here talking about it, but months went by, maybe a year, I don't really even know. What, on my knees saying my prayers one night, dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today, amen. And I started to get up, and I realized I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it didn't happen that day. It had already happened. This was a big problem in my life, and I missed when it ended. I got back down on my knees that day, and I thanked God for this. Wasn't even sure what the feeling was. But I said that day to God, you know, I believe, God, if you mean for me to stay married to this man, I could do that and stay sober and have a happy life. Thank you. Not long after that, we found out that he had cancer. My first thought is, I wish I'd have left him when I hated him. See, it's all about me. This is going to hurt now. I'm very glad it didn't happen when I hated him. Very glad. He was sick for a year and a half, and he did die. It was the hardest year and a half of my life up to that point, but it was the best year and a half of our marriage. Far and away the best year and a half of our marriage. I was so grateful. The day of his funeral, a couple hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous took the afternoon off to be there. They didn't know him, but they came that day for me. And I realized sitting in that chapel that day that what my sponsor had promised me had happened. I knew that day that I had 100% made my amends to him. I felt sad, obviously, that day, but I felt absolutely clean and whole and right about that relationship. I knew that I had 100% made my amends to him. I was so, so grateful that I had stayed when all of my best judgment suggested I should leave. Now, here's how I think. I'm thinking at that time, wow, this is like the big payoff. I hate that word, but I don't know what other word to use. This is like the big payoff for making those daily living amends to him. This is fantastic that I get this feeling of knowing that I have made those amends. My vision is so much smaller than God's vision. That wasn't even close to the big payoff, not even by a million miles. After he died, I started dating Vince, who is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Many of you knew him. We got married, and we had a great life together, really, really great life together. And I know, for me, it would not have been possible at all had I not learned the tools there with my former husband. It would never have happened. It would never have happened. We had such a happy life together. He died, obviously, if you didn't know. You probably guessed by now. He died a few years ago, and my heart broke. I mean, it really broke. I thought, I don't know how a person could feel this bad and still walk around, you know. But I did. I just kept putting one foot in front of the other and I got through it. And here's the important thing too. If you're new or not so new, never once, did the thought of picking up a drink cross my mind. I felt so bad for 2 years I could hardly stand it, but not once did I think about a drink because I've been in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous all these years. You know, I was surrounded by people who loved me and took care of me. I'm talking a long time, but I really do want to talk about money, just briefly. Vince and I owed a lot of money when we got together, and we paid it off, and we made some mistakes, and we struggled, and sometimes we were working, and sometimes we weren't. We were rich, and we were poor. You know, you never quite knew how it was going to be, and so it was a struggle that we had. And then one day, a girl I sponsored and her husband came to us and said, "We're having a little trouble with money, and we're thinking maybe you could give us some advice." So we did. You know, we said, it's like sponsorship. You know, I can see your problems and what you ought to be doing, but I can't see it in myself, and it's pretty much like that. So we looked at them. They were in a huge mess. And so we gave them some serious advice. Do this, do that. And they did it, and things got better. Then some girlfriend of hers, was having a little, Nancy said, "Oh, you should go talk to Vince and Pat. They really helped us." And the next thing you knew, finance class was born. And finance class is really an amends class. It's not just, people think sometimes it's like about getting a budget and it's not. It's for people who are screwed up. There's finance class graduates in here in this very room right now today. Alcoholics are selfish people. We want what we want when we want it. You know, that's how we get in financial trouble, maybe I can't really afford this, but I'll just charge it. It's not really like spending money. I was talking to somebody about that this weekend. You know, when you use a charge card, it doesn't feel like you're really spending money, you know. Anyway, this finance class thing grew into this, 60 people every Sunday morning, getting together. And then people have gone through it, now become finance class teachers. It's this fantastic thing. Vince used to say, the thing about finances and alcoholics is we're so secretive about it. We don't want anybody to know. He used to say, people will get to the podium and tell you the most intimate details of their sex life, but don't ask them about their money. You know, and it's true. It's really true. And everybody in finance class, everybody who winds up there, often they're sent by their sponsors, everybody who winds up there has essentially the same problem. if only I made a little more, this is what they think, if only I made a little more money, I'd be okay. If they make 20, and we've had people in finance class who make $20,000 a year, and we've had people who make several million. And the problem is exactly the same. The numbers are different, you know, but the problem is exactly the same. If only I made a little more, it would be okay. Not so much. Wait a minute, where's my Kleenex? Hold on one second here. Be right with you. So, you know, it grew and grew. Now, as the years went by with finance class, I sort of took a back seat. And then I kind of wasn't involved at all. And then Vince died. Now, finance class still goes on in West Los Angeles. It's going strong. I don't live there anymore. I recently retired from my job and I moved to Palm Desert. And a girl that I know in AA, you know, a peer in AA called me, who lives out there, called me, and she said, I have a girl I'm sponsoring who's having a little trouble with her money. Do you think you could work with her? And I said, oh, you know what? That's really like was Vince's deal. And she said, no, I really think you could help her. I said, yeah, well, you know, I mean, it really was Vince's deal. It really wasn't my thing at all. And she said, no, Pat, I really think you could help her. It's like that old thing, you know, God, where would you have me serve? Yeah, no, I'm not there. You know? And so I said, okay, fine, I'll meet with her, you know. And so now I've got like three or four people that, you know, it appears that we're going to have a Palm Desert finance class. I don't know. It's not where I saw my path going, but what do I know? I don't know where I'm supposed to be, you know. I love this program. I love this program so much. I'll just tell you one more little thing about finances, then I will sit down. When Vince and I bought our first house, we borrowed several thousand dollars from my father for the down payment, which he was happy to loan us. And he said, don't worry about making payments back to me right away. I know when you buy a new house, there's things, you know, a washing machine or, you know, stuff you got to get. So, you know, take your time and don't, you know, not just, so we took our time, all right. Time passed, and I kept thinking, it was several thousand dollars that we had borrowed, and so I was thinking, well, I'll pay him in $500 increments. Well, I just could never seem to get $500 together, you know, and time passed, a lot of time passed. My father never mentioned it, never. But every time I talked to him, I thought about it. And it was definitely between us. It was, that money was this high between us. Finally, came to mind that perhaps I could send, oh, I don't know, $25 a month maybe. And I'll tell you, when I sent that first $25, that barrier was gone, you know, and I just started sending him money every month. And then, of course, you know, the amounts got bigger as time went by and I paid it off. And, but the real message there is the minute I started, you know, it's not like you have to finish it to get the benefit. Once I'm in the solution, I always feel better. I love being sober. I love the rewards, for lack of a better word to use. I can't think of a better word at the moment that you get from being sober. When I came here, I thought it was just going to be like you get sober and you don't drink. And, boy, it sounds like a long time to live without drinking, you know. It sounds kind of painful, actually. And there's a line at the end of, in the 12 and 12, at the end of Step 8 that says, it is the beginning of the end of isolation from our fellows and from God. What more could a person want? Thank you very much.